2 Samuel chapter number 17 is where we are at tonight. 2 Samuel chapter number 17, that is in the Old Testament. If you start in Genesis and start trucking, you're going to hit Joshua and Judges. Keep trucking, you're going to come across Samuel. If you get to Kings or Job, you've gone too far. And I appreciate Brother Dustin and all our instrumentalists and all our singers. And man, I was enjoying praising the Lord. And then my wife leans over and says, "You need to stop. You sound awful." So I think that was wife code for you need to save your voice for the preaching of God's word. So I appreciate the encouragement, hon. So 2 Samuel 17 is where we'll be. That's how I'm going to take it anyway. So 2 Samuel chapter 17 is where we're going to be. So we continue on our series in talking about God's grace and weakness. We've been seeing this in the life of Saul and now David, and now David and his sons in the divided kingdom and the civil war that's taking place. We're in 2 Samuel tonight, and I want you to look at verse 15, where we're going to pick up where we left off last week with Hushai and Ahithophel. Ahithophel's rise and fall as a counselor to Absalom. Hushai as David's spy, giving contradictory counsel on purpose to try to preserve David and his health and his men's health as well. So that's taking place. We're picking up in verse 15. Then it said Hushai to Zadok and to Abiathar, the priest, "Thus and thus did Ahithophel counsel Absalom, the elders of Israel, and thus have I counseled. Now therefore, send quickly, tell David, saying, lodge not this night in the plains of the wilderness, but speedily pass over, lest the king be swallowed up and all the people that are with him." Just a recap and a reminder. Remember, Ahithophel had the wise counsel. He said to Absalom, "You need to get David and you need to get him now. You need to blitzkrieg this man. He's weak. He's vulnerable. You can't give David a second chance here. Now's the time to strike." And Hushai said, "Oh, no, 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 no. You need to take all of the nations with you and show yourself mighty. Show your forces. Then go after David." What's David right now, basically? And foolishly, Absalom listens to Hushai's terrible counsel, which God allowed to defeat actually wise strategic counsel of Ahithophel. So that's what's happened. Hushai is now letting David know what has taken place. And so look at verse number 17. "Now Jonathan and Ahimez stayed by Enrogel, for they might not be seen to come into the city. And a wench went and told them, and they went and told King David. Nevertheless, a lad saw them and told Absalom. But they went, both of them, away quickly and came to a man's house in Bahurim, which had a well in his court, and whither they went down. And the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and spread ground corn thereon, and the thing was not known. And when Absalom's servants came to the woman to the house, they said, 'Where is Ahimaaz and Jonathan?' And the woman said unto them, 'They be gone over the brook of the water.' And when they had sought and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. It came to pass, after they were departed, that they came up out of the well and went and told King David and said to David, 'Arise, pass quickly over the water,'" the Jordan that is, "'for thus saith Ahithophel that he's counseled against you.' And David arose and all the people that were with him, and they passed over Jordan. By the morning light there lacked not one of them that was not gone over Jordan. And when Ahithophel saw his counsel was not followed, he saddled his ass, he arose and gat him home to his house, to his city, put his household in order, and hanged himself and died, and was buried in the sepulcher of his father. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom passed over Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. And Absalom made Amasa captain of the host instead of Joab, which Amasa was a man's son whose name was Eranthinus, an Israelite, that went into Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister to Zeruah, Joab's mother. So Israel and Absalom pitched in the land of Gilead. And it came to pass when David was come to Mahanaim that Shobi, the son of Nahash of Rabbah, of the children of Ammon, and Maker, the son of Emiel of Lodabar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite of Rogillim brought, this is why you just should cough through those names, right? Brought beds and basins and earthen vessels and wheat and barley and flour and parched corn and beans and lentils and parched pulse and honey and butter and sheep and cheese of kind for David and for the people that were with him to eat. For they said, the people is hungry and weary and thirsty and in the wilderness. Tonight we want to talk about crosshairs cannot hinder God's care. Looks like we might have the wrong slides in there. That's a bummer. All right, so you just will follow along with me. Crosshairs cannot hinder God's care. We're going to look at tonight this passage, and I want to try to dovetail it into what we spoke about this morning about God and his care for those who are persecuted, and even seeing David experiencing some of that here tonight. So to do so, I'd like to, throughout the sermon, introduce us to somebody who was arrested for being a Bible smuggler and a follower of Jesus in North Korea. His name is Jin, or Min Jin. He says this in his interview. Each time a new customer walked through the door of the small coffee shop in South Korea where Min Jin shared his story with us as we took his interview, he hesitated or stopped talking completely when people walked by. He's a middle-aged North Korean man, and he studied each person's face anxiously, searching for clues to his or her intent. He knew from his experience that he could never be too careful, even outside North Korea. Spies often cross the border into South Korea to find defectors, report their names to the North Korean government, which then punishes their relatives still living in the country. He goes on record as saying this, in North Korea, no one trusts each other, who even suspected his wife of being a spy. We have to be very cautious about how we think and very careful with our words, and I still have that kind of tendency even today. I get a little nervous, and I look back and forth always wondering what people around me are thinking or what they might be recording. So with the coffee grinder providing background noise, he gradually opened up more and more about his story, about how he became a follower of Christ and a Bible smuggler in the most restricted nation on earth. As we go on through the sermon, I'll keep unloading his story along the way to see where it took him for being a follower of Jesus and how he was in the crosshairs over and over, but how God cared for him again and again. Let's give a brief recap as we're reminded here. David has fled from Jerusalem because of Absalom's coup south in Hebron where it was. As they flee, David had several of his upper-ranking cabinet members and priests stay behind to do what? Provide espionage for him to know what was taking place in Absalom's regime. Now, Pastor Derek did a wonderful job last week reminding us of the pride and haughtiness that eventually led to Ahithophel's fall in his service to the foe king, even ending, unfortunately, in the taking of his own life. This week, we find that espionage network operating as it should, giving King David all the needed intel he would have before this massive conflict between the forces of Absalom and the forces of Joab, or King David's forces led by Joab. Now, throughout this narrative, we're going to watch God care for David again and again and again by taking care of those people and places and surroundings that were out of his control. Here in our passage, we're going to see that God cares for David and his followers by shielding their spies from harm, but then also providing supplies for them as well in their time of need. And if there was a truth we could take away tonight, here's what it'd be. Even when people seek our harm, God orchestrates his care for his people through the aid of others. Even when people seek our harm, God orchestrates his care for his people. As we start into our passage tonight, I want to begin with this idea. God can overturn the harm intended by others. God can overturn the harm intended by others. We start here in verse 15, seeing that Hushai, David's chief spy and trusted counselor, has given counsel to the coup leader, Absalom, that is contrary to strategy that would be sufficient against King David, as we already mentioned. So as this scene unfolds, catch it. This coup is moving quickly. Hushai is there giving bad strategic advice that's being accepted because, as Pastor Derek did a good job of mentioning, he just really played on Absalom's pride, really played on his ego. And so he takes the bad information that he has given to relay it to David for his safety and the safety of those who are following them. So we read it. What does he do? He sends this message through the priests through a lady to the two men who could get to David the fastest, being younger men and also not as easily seen, as it were. So David is given this escape plan away from Absalom's rage. You can see it maybe on the map that's going to be on the screen. David has traveled there from Jerusalem, and he's trying to get across the fords of the Jordan there to have a little bit of space, distance, and safety between him and the forces of Absalom. Now, this is why Ahithophel's counsel is smart. David has to cross a lot of terrain with a lot of people with no supplies hardly, and then he has to forge the waters of Jordan. If Ahithophel's counsel is followed, David's a goner. David would not likely survive at all. So Hushai's bad strategic advice that plays on Absalom's ego is exactly what God allows for. So here's what's taking place. The narrator gives us the scene of how this event takes place. It goes from Hushai to the two men, through a lady, to the two faster, younger men to get that message conveyed to David. And I would just want you to put yourself in that scene. We often read the Bible, again, too flat and germane. This is a tense moment. This coup is happening. Eyes and ears are everywhere that are loyal to what I would call the faux king, Absalom. This lady here who relays the word along does so at great peril to herself and her household. But it's a great act of faith, showing she believes God will care for her, her household, and she believes in the true anointed king line that God established through David. And so what does she do? She goes under the premise of needing to take care of water, which seems to have maybe been her job in that household, and she takes that opportunity or that errand to translate this message to the other spies. But then catch it. The narrator makes it clear. As this is taking place, there happens to be just one person who spots them, right? Like they were so careful. They were so intentional. And then what happens? One boy, it says, one lad sees them. And what's he do? Immediately he runs to tell the faux king Absalom. Why does he do it? Well, I don't know. Maybe there was a reward. Maybe he was out of fear. I have no idea. Maybe he wants to be famous. I don't have any idea. But he brings his word back to the faux king, and he dispatches a search party, as it were, to find these people to stop word from getting to David. He has them in his crosshairs. Now, I want you to feel the tension. There's so many moving parts here. There's so much secrecy and uncertainty. There's so many things that could go wrong, the fear, the anxiety, and the panic. And I would just ask you to think, who's caring for it all when it's beyond all of their control? David can only do what he can do. Hushai can only do what he can do. The spies can only do what they can do. Who can care for the things that they can't care for themselves when they're in the crosshairs? It's, of course, our God. We read this, and sometimes we read it without the tension that our brothers and sisters were going through in this passage. We sometimes read this and forget that this is the daily lifestyle of some of our brothers and sisters around the world. This kind of tension, this kind of difficulty for following Jesus Christ. I want you to put yourself there where the story we've started reading about, that man had to live with every single day. How could he live, much less thrive, in such circumstances? How do they do that? Because they believe that their God knows. They believe that their God cares. They believe their God is at work even when they have misfortune in their lives. And they believe God can even overturn all that is taking place or shield them from it or preserve them through it. We pick up the story of our friend we read about earlier. He becomes a believer on a lengthy business trip to China in 2004. While there, he visits a friend's church and falls in love with the Bible and, as he calls it, all the weird stories it has in it. 5 months later, he gets baptized. After getting baptized, he received a small Korean Bible, growing his understanding of the scriptures. But now he has to return to North Korea from his business trip. He prepares to leave China, and someone from the church made a bold request to him. Would you be willing to accept a shipment that included 10 hidden Bibles going back to North Korea with you? He says, at first I declined. I was already nervous about bringing my own Bible into the country, and if the border guards caught me with even a few pages, I could be imprisoned, tortured, or killed. He knew that receiving the shipment of Bibles could result in his imprisonment in one of their notorious concentration camps in North Korea. He records he agonized over the decision. He remembered that he had given his life to Christ, and it was no longer his own, so he decides to trust God with the decision to bring in those Bibles. He says this, I believe in God, and I believe God has the ability to do anything that's possible. I can do anything he wants, even if it looks difficult, because I know he is the one able to do the work even when I cannot. He records this, the shipment arrived at his house, or arrived months later with him, so he could return to North Korea. At 1 a.m. on a morning in November 2005, he approached a boat along the bank of the Yalu River, praying for God's protection and guidance along every step of the way. After retrieving three large vinyl duffel bags, he hoisted them onto his back and ran towards his home in the dark. Once inside the relative safety of his own home, he opened the bags to find them packed tightly with pants, but wrapped randomly within the clothing were 10 small Korean Bibles. He says this, I was afraid. I was nervous. Receiving them was fine. But then now that I've opened them, I began to wonder, what am I going to do with these? Who can I distribute these to? And I began to have doubts about what I had decided to do. So he declares, I kept the items hidden until God would give me the right people at the right time. He said it's in February of 2006. He was walking through a village and heard someone whistling a Christian hymn he had become familiar with. The hymn was, The Trusting Heart to Jesus Clings. He had learned it during his time in China. He followed the man, made note of where he lived, and decided to deliver some Bibles to him that night under the cover of darkness. And at midnight, he rewrapped 8 of the 10 Bibles in his pants and left them at the man's front door. He didn't leave a note because he didn't want it traced back to him. My friend, when we're in the crosshairs, God is still caring for us. As we think about David's story or narrative continuing and the people around that story being in the crosshairs, I want you to think about number 2 tonight. God can work despite the frailty of sinners. God can work despite the frailty of sinners. In verse 18, catch what's going on here. In verse number 18, nevertheless, a lad saw them. So that puts the whole plan in peril, doesn't it? He sees them. This once easy plan to move this message along has now been disrupted. So now this search party is chasing them. They went south from Jerusalem. Now they're trying to go to a city north of Jerusalem so they can try to get to news to David before, so he can get across the fords of the Jordan there. And they've been aided by loyalists along the way. But now they're on the run, even as you can see on this map here. They're on the run with eyes everywhere. And they end up in this city right there. If you're looking at the map and you see where Jerusalem is, it's just barely northeast there. As they run into that city, they're able to somehow locate some people that they find loyal to David. And they want to hide there on their premises. And so they have them hide in maybe what would be the worst hiding spot possible, a cistern or a well, as it's called here. Now, get it, this is not like a flowing down from the ground well. This is likely somebody who is wealthy and they have a private water supply that they come and fill up. And so it's a holding tank or a storage tank. It could be dry, it could be filled with water. Let me get you an idea of what this looks like. You can see here on the photo there, that's just an idea. Like if we were standing at one, it may be a circle like that, usually flat along the ground or a few rocks, and it'd go down just to be a holding tank. This is a massive one. If you've ever heard of Masada or you've been to Masada, you know what this is. That was the massive holding tank for water on top of the mountain there at Masada. So they are in what would be a dark, tight, confined, strategically indefensible hiding place. I can't imagine what has to be going through their mind, but it's the best place they can hide. And we read in the account, what'd she do? She has them get in it, She puts something down. She puts a bunch of corn on top of it. So it's as innocuous as could be. It looks as normal and benign as possible. But that's not enough. What takes place? They have a search party with credible intel. And in verse 20, due to that credible intel, they knock on the door, as it were. Can you imagine the conversation? Hey, we saw two men enter here according to intel. Do you know anything about them? Two men? Maybe. You know, what's it like for her? My wife tells me I'm not a very good liar. Can you imagine if this lady was like me? My poker face is terrible, apparently. This lady, hey, did they come in here? We have neighbors who confirmed it. Don't make us tear the place apart. Are they here? They know where to look. They know who they're looking for. They know them by name, apparently, and the appearance enough to search there. They have the authority to go door to door because of the faux king with nothing standing in his ruthless way. And now the narrator seems to present us a bizarre moment, and maybe what one would call an ethical problem, as we're encountered with Hushai and how he possibly praised Absalom. They ask the lady if they've been there. She doesn't deny it fully. What does she say? Yeah, they were here, but where'd they go? Beyond the brook. They're no longer here. They've passed over out of the city. The omission of any mention of the man of the house makes it clear that in some way he deliberately made sure his day routine looked normal so nothing was out of place. And also he would have been believed as the more likely person to believe in that scenario because of how they treated the word of women in ancient Near Eastern culture. So they strategically have this lady there because maybe she'll be seen as less credible or reliable of a witness. And she does what? Well, there's no way around it. She lies. Did they cross over the brook? I mean, they're eventually going to cross over the brook. But are they there in the well? Yeah, they are. Does she know they're there in the well? Absolutely. It's a lie. But I tell us, friends, it's nothing we haven't encountered before in the scripture where somebody intentionally lies. Sometimes we see it in the scripture due to ignorance. Sometimes we see it due to the newness of their faith. Sometimes we see it because they're valued in a higher priority like life. In this case, one could even say that she is valuing the true authority of God through the anointed king line. But whatever way around it, it doesn't make it okay that she lied, but neither does it stop God from being able to work despite her frailties and despite her dishonesty. I want us to recognize that God, even when David's in the crosshairs, is able to move and able to work when there's ill intended towards him, even through frailties like sinfulness or even lying. God is not limited in his ability to work and care and move. We join up with the friend we've been talking about. It says months later, when he returned to China with the intent of defecting in November 2006, he was arrested and unfortunately extradited to North Korea. In prison, he met a former friend who had been arrested because of his Christian faith. And as they talked, he began to realize that the man he gave the Bibles to was this man's uncle. The man had been arrested, and all of the family members, all 27, were actually in that prison camp. The man records that he didn't get to spend any time with him while there, except for one, and he found out that the entire 27 had begun gathering secretly to read the Bibles he had left. And as they read and discussed the scriptures, they became followers of Jesus. And finally, one of their neighbors reported them for hearing them sing praises to God in the middle of the night at one point. And so all 27 were arrested when the secret police raided their home and put them into this jail. As he heard of the family members there, he didn't get to see all of them, but he recorded, I got to hear some of them nearby me praying. He said, I never told my friend that I was the one who left the 8 Bibles on his uncle's doorstep because I thought it was still too risky. He records a month later, all 27 members, including himself, his uncle, and his friend are sent to a concentration camp. As we move forward in David's narrative, I want you to see this. God can provide for us when we are at our weakest. Once you see in verse 21 what starts to take place, the counsel of Ahithophel is relayed to David. David is able to escape, as you even see on the map there. He's able to cross the ford of the Jordan. They do something daring and really not what you would want to do. It's not really wise, but they were desperate. They cross this body of water at night. Every single one of the people that are with David have to make this journey just in case Absalom changes his mind and decides to blitz Kerigam. They got to get across this water or they're sitting ducks. As we saw last week in 23, Ahithophel ends his life. And then in verses 24 through 26, the foe king appoints Joab's cousin and David's nephew, Amasa, to lead his armies against him. Now, the armies are gathering there on the north side, kind of that reddish line. They're gathering there in Gilead. So catch it. David is able to escape and able, at that green line shows, to set up kind of a camp. But Absalom, even though Hushai's counsel was followed, kind of figures out, wait a minute, I need to chase David. So he chases, he gets his army set up. They're getting ready for this massive battle that's going to take place. I would just remind us, as we read this, this is serious. This is tension filled. This is problematic relationally with each other. Why? Because it's a civil war. There are brothers against brothers. Something when we read American history, we cannot directly relate to, but we can historically understand took place even in our own country, right? Where there were households split and divided, shooting at one another in the civil war that we had in our own country. You, if you're there in this time with David in this coup by Absalom, you're having to make choices. If the people in your city are pro-David, you're going to be pro-Absalom? If the city's pro-Absalom, you want to be pro-David? It makes it very tense, very difficult, and that's the kind of environment that we're finding here. This massive military force is setting up camp against their former king. And here David is. He and his loyal followers, tired, weary, but it's, like I said, about to get worse. Because while they were able to ford the Jordan, now they realize, like a black hole in a vent horizon, the foe king's forces have a line on his position. It's just a matter of time till all of this is over. And it almost feels like he's been in the crosshairs, and then when God is needing to step in most, he abandons and forgets David. It's almost like when David was finally going to escape and get across the Jordan and get regrouped and figure it out, oh, Absalom sweeps in, and he's going to be able to catch David and complete the coup. And that would be true if it weren't for 27 and 28. Look what happens here in 27 and 28. It's looking ugly. Nothing seems to be going, quote, David's way. His spies got the intel, but then this little brat ratted them out to the king. They're trying to get across, but then Absalom decides to follow him anyway. When David comes to Mahanaim there in verse 27, all of a sudden, friends start to show up, don't they? I want you to look at verse 27 for a second and see the three friends he has show up. That was just pastor speak to let me take a drink. He has three friends. People that maybe he's been in contact with before or regularly, we don't know. But all of a sudden, the narrative changes when unexpected allies aid David and his followers. Well, who are these fellas? Well, the first one, Shobi, is probably the person who David has appointed as the governor over Rabbah back in chapter number 12, if you look back then, in his wisdom and caring for that area, that region, and that person he put over him. Second one is Maker. He seems to have been somebody who cared for Mephibosheth before David was made aware of Mephibosheth's situation and need. You can find that in 2 Samuel chapter number 9. You can see the last fella, he's mentioned in the future in chapter 19. We don't have a lot of background except to see he in some way is also connected and loyal to David and also a follower of God. So catch this. When it seems like David is hopeless and helpless and all of his forces are going to just be annihilated, God has not forgotten about him and yet sweeps in with three relationships from the past. And what do they have? Well, they pretty much have a Walmart or Amazon order on their hands, don't they? They bring beds, basins, utensils, non-perishable foods to make bread and sustaining meals. They even bring what? They even bring desserts along with them as well. They're bringing butter, they're bringing biscuits, they're bringing a little bit of everything. The way I think about it like this is God is showing forth in this moment really what David would write about in Psalm 23. What did he write about in Psalm 23:5? Do you remember? He said, you're going to set, I'm paraphrasing here, a table before me in the very presence of mine enemies. David's in the middle of nowhere, and he's getting this Instacart order dropped on him, right? And here's what I want you to consider here with me. David's people are hungry and tired and weary. They lack everything, and yet God has not forgotten them. God may give us great stewardship and opportunity to care for our needs, even our wants, but friends, he delights to support us through our weakest moments in life. The weakest moments physically, financially, spiritually, relationally, and emotionally. Catch it. Your God, David's God, the brother's God we've been talking about from North Korea, that God is not handcuffed. He's not on a limited budget. He's not limited in any way, shape, or form. His care would like be like having the resources of Alibaba and Amazon and Walmart with the cash reserves of Apple. And even that kind of combination would still be limited compared to our God. This is the same God who would inspire David to write in Psalm 50, "For every beast of the forest is mine, and the cattle upon a thousand hills. I know all the fowls of the air and all the fowls of the mountain, the wild beasts of the field, they are mine. And if I were hungry, I would not tell thee, for the world is mine and the fullness thereof." Friends, God cares for us in weak times. He cares for us in wealthy times. He cares for us, guess what? All the time. All the time. When you're at your weakest moment, no matter what that may look like and or feel like, God has not forgotten and or abandoned you. We conclude our story that we've been reading along. He was released after 7 months in prison. In 2014, he was successfully defected to South Korea. He remains concerned. He said he even feels a bit guilty about the Christian family suffering in the concentration camp. After all, he knows he's the one who supplied the Bibles that led to their imprisonment. Still, he knows that God ultimately provided the Bibles and that he's the one who's allowing them to suffer for his name. He's quoted as saying this, "I believe that these 27 people are children of God, and God is going to somehow release them miraculously as well." This man has gone on to serve in a variety of ways in his church and then also participate with helping other people who have been able to defect. He's been used again and again, and he's quoted as saying this, "This is my heart. This is my prayer. I would go through it all again because I want North Korean people to hear the gospel and to be able to share the gospel. That is my daily prayer." Time after time, he was in the crosshairs. It didn't always go the way he'd like it to or the way he wanted it to, but God cared for him step by step, moment by moment, day by day. He was caring for those 27 people in that concentration camp as well. And he cared for David in this passage in this time of his life. It's my prayer tonight that we recognize from this account about David and his friends, as well from the story from the Voice of Martyrs, as well as the passage we saw this morning, that we are blessed and can rejoice, and there is a reward for suffering persecution, for following Jesus Christ, that we would be reminded that every moment of our lives is within the care of our good God. And if not one bird falls to the ground that he doesn't know about, and one hair doesn't fall off your head that he doesn't know about, he cares. You don't have to doubt it. Are we going to struggle at times with it? You better believe it. We're human. We struggle to believe that our God does care when he allows what we don't desire into our life. But my friends, no matter the grief or heaviness we're facing tonight, realize your God is not restrained in his extravagant care for you, spiritually, emotionally, physically, financially, relationally. He cares for us. Even when people seek our harm, God orchestrates his care for his people through the aid of others. As we close, I want you to consider a few things. Are you like David tonight in a very difficult or weak situation where you do find yourself wondering what the end or the outcome is going to be? I would just try to, as your brother reminds you, your God has not forgotten or abandoned you, though it may feel like it right now, that he knows exactly what's going on. He is providing and caretaking for you through it. He will sustain you and guide you through it. And he is using it, like he said in 2 Corinthians 1, to grow your faith, to give you the comfort. He's the God of all comfort. He's given you grace, and he's going to use that for a testimony to those who you are going to minister to the gospel and those you're going to minister to as your brother or sister in Christ. So if you're here tonight and you're in the midst of such a strain or a struggle, I know we can't make it go away. I know we can't make it be better like that. I just remind you of your character, of your good and loving and kind God. Secondly, you might be here and say, I'm not in that spot. I mean, things aren't perfect, but when is it ever perfect, right? But I'm not in the spot of what I'd feel is just absolute weakness and dependency and difficulty in my life, where it's just there's so many things out of control and uncertain and topsy-turvy. Then I would provoke us to think of the brothers and sisters who are. And how would we know that unless we ask? Listen, sometimes when we come through the doors of church, we're guilty of doing what? How are you? Good. We joke in our family, it's called the church smile. Just turn that thing on. Church smile's on three, right? How would we know if we don't ask? And how would they know if we're not transparent? I grieve what I see as a pastor becoming more and more common in church and Christian culture. We're more open with people far outside our close circle who actually can't do much for us except commiserate about it, maybe with us, but won't hold us accountable or help us, than the people who are supposed to be in that circle. What do you mean? Well, we'll go put it on the internet, or we'll go tell somebody at work about how hard things are. We'll go talk to a best friend about how stinky our marriage is. And yet we won't go to the very people God has us practicing or wants us to practice the one another's with. My friends, there are people around us who hurt and who suffer and who struggle. Yes, it's a two-way street. They got to be open about it. But let's be a little bit more prying than maybe we want to be. Let's be open to that ourselves. And then let's not be short-sighted not to remember our brothers and sisters around the world who live in the crosshairs daily. I'm going home tonight. I'm good. I'm safe. I'm not worried about anybody knocking on my door. Nobody I can't meet with a Glock, so I'm not worried about that. And I doubt you are too, mostly. I don't think any of you tomorrow, if you prayed over your food in a prayer of thanks at lunch, not because you have to, not because it's Christian to do, but you just decided, I'm going to offer a prayer of thanks at lunch. And you prayed out loud, arms up, head bowed, and you prayed a prayer of thanks. You're not worried about getting dragged out of your work, are you? But as we heard tonight, there are brothers and sisters around the world that weren't even able to do maybe what we just did earlier. We're just singing open and loud. My encouragement, if you're struggling tonight, God knows he cares, even if it doesn't feel like he does. Recognize if you're not, find somebody who is and be a help like God desires to be. And then, though it's beyond our control, maybe beyond our way to be a help, let's remember our brothers and sisters around the world. You can look up a variety of different websites to find what's going on around the world to brothers and sisters in Christ. Follow any of your missionaries in the 1040 window. Follow any of the organizations that are doing work there. You will see what our brothers and sisters are struggling through every day in a tension-filled environment in the crosshairs. But take heart. God cares for them. And he wants to hear your prayers for them as well. So let's take a moment. Let's take a moment in silence here. Won't worry about the instruments or anything. And we'll give you the chance to just consider your God his care for you, how he wants to use you in helping others in their care as well. And then think about the brothers and sisters who are struggling around the world.